From NPR News, this is the podcast of the best of weekends on All Things Considered, the highlights from our show this weekend. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. This episode, back in the 19th century, the mentally ill were warehoused in horrific asylums. Today, they fill the nation's jails.
The jail was never meant to be a state hospital.
Why the problem is growing worse. And fewer fires means different and challenging work for firefighters.
If you would have asked me this 5-10 years ago, I would say yes, I missed the fires.
Then, how a bassoon got stuck as the orchestra's class clown.
My dad said it looked like a plumber had gotten drunk.
Plus music from Glen Campbell and a rare tour of one of New York's newest and most popular public parks. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Half a century ago, mentally ill people were often locked away in insane asylums, places built like castles with grand staircases and large gardens.
The asylums in the 19th century, some of them were the largest buildings of their time.
Chris Payne photographed these now decrepit buildings for his book, Asylum.
They thought that the architecture and the buildings in this lush landscape, this almost utopian environment, could actually transform people and help them feel better.
Instead, many asylums became houses of horror. We'll hear more from Payne in a few minutes. But what happened to all of those people? Many states shut down their mental hospitals in the 1980s. 600,000 former residents were supposed to find support in community mental health centers. But those centers rarely had enough money, and they still don't. Now, 3 decades later, more than 1 million people a year with mental illness are finding a home in the two places that can't turn them away, jail and prison.
We have a criminal justice system which has a very clear purpose. You get arrested, we want justice, we try you, and, you know, justice hopefully prevails. It was never built to handle people that were very, very ill.
That's Steve Leifman. He's a judge in Miami, Florida. And he says the result has not been good for the mentally ill, the taxpayers, or the criminal justice system. That's our cover story today. The nation's courts, jails, and mental illness. Judge Leifman has seen the problem firsthand for a decade. People often stand before his bench with no sense of where they are or who they are. And for years, he wasn't able to do much to help them.
What we used to do, which I tell people was the definition of insanity because we kept doing the same thing again and again and expected a different outcome, they would commit an offense, the police would arrest them, they'd come to court, they'd be acting out, so we would order 2 or 3 psychological evaluations at great expense. We would determine that they were incompetent to stand trial and we would release them back to the community and kind of held our breath and crossed our fingers and hoped that somehow they'd get better and come back and we could try them, but they would just disappear and get rearrested.
How soon would you often see some of the same people come back?
Sometimes within minutes.
You're kidding. Minutes?
Yeah, they'd walk out the door. They were floridly ill. They'd act out because it's next to the courthouse. There's several officers out there, and they'd get rearrested.
Hmm.
And just to give you a clear picture in your mind of what I'm talking about is we did a sampling, and we asked one of our institutions, the University of South Florida, to look at who our highest utilizers of criminal justice and mental health services were in Miami-Dade County. And they were able to narrow it down to 97 people who, as it turned out, were primarily diagnosed with schizophrenia. But over a 5-year period, these 97 individuals were arrested almost 2,200 times. And it cost the taxpayers
$13
million.
$13 million for
97 million.
People?
We would have been off sending them to Harvard. And the problem is, because the system doesn't really know what to do with them, they just keep recycling again and again. And this goes on in every single community in the United States.
You've created somewhat of a novel idea down in Miami-Dade. It's a facility. It's a new facility. Tell me about it.
We were able to get the state to lease the county an old state hospital that's near the jail. And we received $22 million to take this old facility and to restore it and convert it into a forensic diversion facility. And ultimately, what it'll look like, it will be part jail for people that will be getting slated to go into this facility. Once they're stabilized, they'll go to a more longer-term facility, all this in the same building. And they'll continue to step down until they're actually ready to go back into the community. We hope to have what we call a clubhouse model, which is run by people with mental illnesses, where they learn to have day activities, they learn job opportunities, they learn how to cope with their illness, they learn how to be involved in their own self-recovery. And look, we can't help everybody, but if we can keep 50% of the people who are coming into our jail out who have serious mental illness, we've made a huge, huge dent in the problem.
That's Miami-Dade County Judge Steve Lifeman. He's chair of the Florida Supreme Court's Task Force on Substance Abuse and Mental Health Issues, and he sits on the bench in Miami-Dade. Thank you so much, Judge, for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
With so many mentally ill people funneling through the court system, it's also become an enormous problem for jail administrators and sheriffs across the country. In Travis County, Texas, Sheriff Greg Hamilton says one of every four people in his jail has a mental illness.
The intent was not to be the largest mental health institute in counties. And it's not just Travis County, it's around the state. And I can tell you that oftentimes officers bring these individuals who have mental illness to jail because there's no beds in that the state hospitals have available.
So what is it like to have that big a population in terms of the actual facility and the operation of it?
Well, it's very costly trying to house mentally ill. Number one, you have to stabilize those individuals if they're going to be in your jail for any length of time. And I'm finding that because of the lack of state beds for inmates to go to, they're spending longer times in our jail.
How long can that be?
Oh, it could be. We've had individuals that have been in our jail for as long as 258 days were the longest.
258 days?
Yes, ma'am. But the average wait is 50 to 100 days.
And you guys have done a lot, especially hiring a psychiatrist on staff, counselors. That's more than most jails have done. But is it enough?
Oh, no, not at all. I can tell you here at the Austin State Hospital, I think that they have a facility for 236, but they have 20 psychiatrists. We have
wow.
1.5.
And how many inmates do you have?
We have 400 daily.
Do you see some of the same inmates coming through again and again?
Oh, yes, ma'am. They are oftentimes, they get out of our facility, and we have stabilized these individuals. But then because of the lack of resources, sometimes it's hard for them to go into a facility to replenish their meds or to see a psychiatrist. So after a while, these individuals go right back into that psychotic behavior, and it seems to me that we have criminalized being mentally ill.
And then it becomes your problem.
Yes, ma'am. I think that's bottom line right there. The jail was never meant to be a state hospital or a treatment facility.
That's Sheriff Greg Hamilton. He runs the Travis County Jail in Austin, Texas. Thanks so much, Sheriff.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
So whatever happened to those grand old castles built with the best of intentions where so many mentally ill people lived and rarely ever got to leave? Chris Payne photographed more than 70 of them in 30 states for his book Asylum. Most have been abandoned behind barbed wire, left to ruin their university-like campuses, farms, and enormous buildings.
And some of these, like Buffalo State Hospital in Buffalo, New York, grew to over a third of a mile long. So the asylums of the 19th century quite simply dominated the landscape.
One of the things you documented in your photographs was how self-sufficient these places were. And you showed these gorgeous pictures of old farms and old equipment and these giant kitchens. And why were they so self-sufficient, though? I mean, did they have to be, or was this a matter of keeping things closed in?
In the beginning, they had this notion. It was called moral treatment. And the idea was that the afflicted would be removed from, let's say, the city and put in one of these utopian environments and put to work. And also, in the 19th century, you know, any remote institution or community had to be self-sufficient.
You took thousands of photographs to put this book together. What are the ones that really stand out for you?
The ones that stand out really are the shot of the toothbrushes. It was an abandoned ward way in the depths of an abandoned hospital, and all of the patients, for some reason, Everyone left their toothbrushes there. And the rest of the building, parts of it, were missing floors. And the fact that this little box of toothbrushes had survived on the wall when the rooms around it were crumbling was incredible. It was a kind of a once-in-a-lifetime find.
And let me also say that listeners can see these photographs at NPR.org. Let's talk about this picture of unclaimed copper cremation urns from the Oregon State Hospital in Salem, Oregon. And it's this kind of, again, a rundown looking room. And I mean, just hundreds of urns. They look like coffee cans. I mean, if you look really quickly, it looks like they left soup behind. Tell me about this photo.
Yeah, so these were unclaimed cremation urns, and they date from the early 20th century. And since there were thousands of people in these institutions, you know, a lot of them were either put there against their will or just kind of left there by their families. And so when they died, they had no one to claim them. And you could often tell the weight or the age of someone by the weight of the can. Most of the inscriptions had fallen off, but it was evident that the ages ranged from somewhere, I think, some children to, you know, some older adults, people who had been there their entire lives.
Since a lot of these buildings are still empty, what's going to happen to them now?
Well, unfortunately, most of them will probably be demolished. Developers will come in, they'll buy the hospital from the state, and then tear down the old buildings and then put up condominiums, because the land that these asylums were situated on was prime real estate. And I guess what bothers me the most is that there's always going to be a segment of the population that could use some kind of institution like an asylum, whether you stay there your whole life or just a few weeks. And why not give that land back to the mentally ill that need it the most, rather than develop it privately?
That's Chris Payne. He's a New York photographer whose book, Asylum, documents state mental hospitals across the country. He joined us from New Zealand, where he's traveling. Chris, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Laura Sullivan. I'm standing in Fire Station 4 in Alexandria, Virginia, and I'm standing in the fire station bay, which is the garage. And here we've got the fire engine and the fire truck with a 100-foot ladder on it. And along the side of the walls are all of the firefighters' jackets and boots lined up. And essentially, this firehouse is just waiting for the alarm to ring. But here's the thing. When that alarm does sound, the chances are they won't be headed to a fire.
70% of our calls are medic calls.
That's Jeff Taylor. He becomes a full-fledged firefighter this week. He used to play fireman when he was a kid, but if you ask him, when is the last time you guys fought a fire? There's a long pause.
We had a car fire a little while ago. Other than that, I had to say about 4 months ago was my last structure fire.
Taylor and the two dozen other firefighters here are still saving lives. They're just doing it on a gurney. Every one of them is an emergency medical technician. It's a dramatic shift for a profession idolized by folklore and the movies. That's the movie Backdraft, which firefighters obsess about.
It's in the walls.
Running into flames, roaring trucks, those huge five-alarm blazes. It just doesn't happen that much anymore. According to the National Fire Protection Association, there are half as many fires as there were 30 years ago. There are more sprinklers, more smoke alarms, better building codes, even more cell phones. People call in when they see smoke before there's a fire. Taylor knew this when he signed up, and he doesn't mind. He likes doing the medical work, and he wouldn't wish a fire on anyone. But still.
It's weird because, yes, we do like the excitement. Some firefighters are labeled as adrenaline junkies. I'm not going to lie. It is an exciting feeling when, you know, you see the flames and the smoke. You get that little excitement, and you're like, okay, we get to do what we've practiced.
Taylor opens a large door.
Now we're going out to the bay. In this bay, we have an engine and a truck.
Big, shiny red fire trucks with hoses neatly folded. On the street, if you see just the small one, the engine, it's going to a medical call. If you see the truck with the 100-foot ladder with the lights on, it's going to an actual fire or a fire alarm.
We do get more alarms than fires, obviously.
Or you can just look for the hats. Firefighters don't wear their hats to medical calls.
If you would have asked me this 5, 10 years ago, I would say, yes, I miss the fires.
Tony Washington is the captain here at Station 4.
But now being a parent myself, owning my own house, having my own kids, I don't enjoy the fires at all. My guys get the excitement in their eyes. I usually don't, because I know that we're going for somebody's worst day, and I don't want to be on the other side of that.
Were there some firefighters who didn't really want to do the medical stuff? I mean, have you seen that over the years?
Yeah, we did see that. And it's our job, the leaders of this department, to make them understand that this is the wave of the future.
The future for them means training for hazardous material spills, a terrorist attack, or doing community outreach, charity drives, and awareness campaigns. They also have to train to understand today's building construction. Because while there are fewer fires, when one does actually get going, it can be far more dangerous. Today's homes have too much glue and particle board, not like 50 years ago.
They were using heavy timber, so the timber had a lot longer time to burn. Okay, now, instead of using this big piece of wood to hold up a building, they're using an engineered piece of wood. It's like having a piece of paper. If I took a piece of paper and lit it on fire, it's going to go up like that. That lighter weight construction is going to go down a lot faster than that heavy timber.
Captain Washington says that means there's a ticking clock. A 50-year-old home will burn for a good while before it collapses. A new home may only burn for a few minutes.
If it's already burning, that the structural members of that house, we don't have time to fight that fire. And as a matter of fact, we're probably going to back out and go defensive on that fire.
So unless there's someone inside, firefighters are more likely to fight that fire from the lawn. In 2 hours at the station, there wasn't a single call. Usually they get about 5 or 6 a day. But there's still work to do, and they head out for their next job, a community charity event. A dozen firefighters throw their heavy jackets and boots and hats into the trucks, just in case there's a fire while they're away. But they're probably not going to need them. Can you name this instrument? Oboe? No. Trombone? It's a bassoon. This instrument is often called the clown of the orchestra. And the truth is, the bassoon has a bit of an identity problem. Producer Lauren Silverman explains.
You might think you haven't heard a bassoon outside a symphony before, but you actually have.
Why is it men refuse to close doors?
Even the closed. There's often a bassoon or a contrabassoon in the background of the Flintstones. And remember Grandpapa from Peter and the Wolf? How about Leave It to Beaver's theme song? And of course, there's Mickey Mouse dancing with the broomstick in Fantasia. Yep, there's a trend here.
Uh-oh, things are going comically awry, and that's the way I think it's often used in television and movies.
That's Eileen Reynolds. She's played the bassoon since elementary school.
When I started playing it, I started getting these really strange comments from people. My dad said it looked like a plumber had gotten drunk because there's all this tubing and all these keys on it everywhere. And then I talked to my great uncle, who'd been a professional trombonist, and he said, you know, we used to call it the farting bedpost.
There, she said it. Eileen admits when you hear those really low notes, it's hard to think of anything else other than... You see, despite the fact that the bassoon is actually one of the most difficult instruments in the orchestra to play, people just don't take it seriously. Which isn't surprising when you get a glimpse of the thing. There's this metal mouthpiece that's curved and it sort of goes down and it looks almost like a straw. You know what? Let's just consult a professional.
And then it's attached to almost 8 feet of wooden tubing that's been fashioned with a bend in the bottom of it. So it's folded in half, and the top part sticks up, and it looks like a bedpost.
That's Mark Eubanks. He teaches bassoon at Lewis and Clark College in Oregon. And he says the bassoon has been the butt of the joke since its early days back in the 17th century.
Bassoon playing was very bad in those days because they had bad instruments. The wood warped, the reeds changed from minute to minute, and there probably weren't that many good bassoon players, so it kind of took on a role as this quirky, nasty-sounding thing.
A century later, with better reeds and more keys, composers began to take notice. Again, Eileen Reynolds.
Haydn may have been the person who started this bassoonist funny idea because he would have a part where the whole orchestra was playing and then it would get quieter and quieter and quieter and everything would be very serene.
And then... whether Haydn was making a joke or just trying to wake people up, he started a trend that Beethoven picked up a century later when he featured the bassoon as buffoon in his Sixth Symphony.
People have compared it to the drunken peasant who stumbles into the party and is just like, bom, bom, bom.
If you missed it, here it comes again. This century, you've probably heard the bassoon on sitcoms such as Curb Your Enthusiasm. Mark Eubanks has had enough of the bassoon being typecast as the Rodney Dangerfield of instruments.
Why can't it play Irish music? Why can't a bassoon do, you know, any kind of ensemble, jazz, rock, whatever?
So Mark jams out with a group of other unists. That's bassoonists, contrabassoonists, tenorunists, and so on. They call themselves the Bassoon Brothers. Only one of them is a sister. They've released 3 CDs, and this isn't Beethoven's bassoon. Don't like the Temptations? How about Hendrix? That's actually an electric bassoon. Mark attaches a small pickup mic to the mouthpiece and then connects guitar pedal effects and an amplifier. And then there's Ben Wendell. When he's not playing the sax, he's jazzing it up on the bassoon.
There are very few bassoonists out there that specifically deal in the world of jazz or improvising. Or like the Illuminati of the jazz world or something.
The bassoon has also made a move into the world of pop. There's a quartet of classically trained bassoonists that covered Lady Gaga's greatest hits. They call themselves the Breaking Winds.
And we're in full Lady Gaga regalia. We have the wigs, we have funky costumes, and kind of all this fabs let out.
That's quartet member Brittany Harrington. She says their video went viral, and before they knew it, they were on MTV. That's right, bassoon on MTV. The bottom line is, modern-day bassoonists aren't trying to change the sound of the instrument. They just want you to know that while it can be bouncy and silly, it can also be romantic, serious, even jazzy. Lauren Silverman, NPR News.
The winner is Molly Reed, and the story is Not That I Care.
Yoav Ben Yosef, and the story is called Not Calling Attention to Ourselves.
It's a beautiful and very unorthodox story called Roosts by Zach Brockhaus.
The winner is Kathy Formusa.
The winning story is a story called A Saint and a Criminal, and it's by Laurie Anderson.
The winner is Rhonda Strickland of Raleigh, North Carolina, with her story called Please Read.
Could you be next? Round 7 of our 3-Minute Fiction contest starts next weekend. Now, for those of you who don't know about 3-Minute Fiction, we ask you to write an original short story that can be read in less than 3 minutes, meaning no more than 600 words. So clean off that keyboard, dust off the typewriter, grab your pens, dig up that quill if you have to, because it all kicks off next Saturday with a new judge and a new challenge. If you just can't wait, you can get in on the conversation on our 3-Minute Fiction Facebook page. In New York City, in Manhattan's famed meatpacking district, you can look up and see an old railroad line, about as wide as 4 cars. It looks like a black iron bridge, but then on a street corner, there's a staircase. And as you climb up and touch the black iron, it opens into a place unlike any other. It's another world called the High Line, a park 2 stories above the ground on top of the old railroad tracks. It's a winding path framed by trees and grasses and wildflowers, a place so improbable, it's difficult to understand how it even exists. But if you walk for a bit,
you'll see a small plaque on a wall explaining how it all got here.
In 1999, with the High Line threatened with demolition, neighborhood residents Joshua David and Robert Hammond formed Friends of the High Line to advocate for the preservation and reuse of the structure.
This is Robert Hammond, by the way, one of the guys on the plaque.
The goal was to create a public landscape as unusual and unexpected as the High Line itself.
The other guy on the plaque, Joshua David, is with me too.
So there you have the whole story. You don't really need to.
So, you know, people might read that and think, you know, this Joshua David and Robert Hammond, they're just two, like, rich guys who came in and threw a bunch of money down and created the High Line. It's not really what happened.
No.
What happened is the subject of a new book co-written by Robert and Josh. It's called High Line, the inside story of New York City's Park in the Sky. That story starts like this. Robert and Josh met at a community board meeting in 1999. People were talking about what to do with the old High Line. It'd been abandoned for 20 years. Just about everyone wanted it torn down.
And I thought Robert was cute, and so in that room of people, I thought, well, I'll sit next to the cute guy.
Robert and Josh never got together in that way.
And I think that was the last time he ever thought I was cute.
But they did get together. And together, these two guys, with no experience in advocacy or organizing or fundraising, Josh was a travel writer and Robert worked at an internet startup. These two guys became a force to be reckoned with. Over 10 years, they formed a nonprofit, galvanized a community, fought the city, and built one of the most unusual parks in the country. Now more than 2 million visitors a year come here, and most start at the bottom of that flight of stairs where we met Josh and Robert.
We're standing under the High Line at the southern end at the corner of Ganzevoort and Washington Street in New York City's Meatpacking District.
Josh and Robert know every foot of this park. They helped design it. And on this day, they gave us a rare insider's tour.
And over our heads, we're under this really massive steel structure with these heavy black steel beams covered with rivets where freight trains used to run over our head.
And this is what I fell in love with, was the steel structure. Yeah. And then once we went up on top, there was this whole other experience with a mile and a half of wildflowers that had just taken over. And the wildflowers seemed, you know, just as strong and just as potent, you know, as the steel structure. And those two things combined, to me, that's what the High Line is.
Well, yeah, let's go upstairs and take a look.
So we're going up what we call the Ganzevoort Stair, because it comes up from Ganzevoort Street. And you can see also just the grass is already pushing through the glass barriers here, and they're hanging, plants hanging off the edge as we go by. The idea that nature is, again, taking over this massive structure was something that was very important in the design.
This is stunning. This is absolutely beautiful. I mean, these are, I mean, you have trees growing up here. I mean, this is incredible. Well, let me ask you guys about this fantastic structure above us. This is the, what is this?
We're standing underneath the Standard Hotel, which opened almost at exactly the same time as the High Line opened in 2009. But it reflects back to the historic relationship of buildings to the High Line. It's when it was originally conceived in the late 1920s, it was conceived as a rail line that would pull up next to buildings, connect to them with sidings, go through buildings. So this is a modern interpretation of the way that buildings used to relate to the High Line.
You know, what it's also well known for is when it opened, there were a lot of stories about people watching, people having sex in the windows from the High Line. And you can still see sometimes people will just stop right over there and just stare up. I mean, I've come up here a lot and I always look. But, you know, you don't see things that often. So I think people that stay there now knows that, you know, you close your curtains.
I have to stop for a second because there are a bunch of things that are happening here that are sort of important. We're standing on a part of the High Line that's called the Diller von Furstenberg Sun Deck. And it has all of these people who are sitting out on these big benches basking in the sun. We're coming up on also another great feature of the High Line, a water feature on the sun deck, where the water is just skimming over the surface of the walkway, and you can take off your shoes like those guys over there and those kids further on.
You can also see that the sun deck chairs are laid along the tracks. And as we've been walking along, you know, sometimes you notice the old rail tracks sticking out from the plantings. So this piece of rail was originally in this exact position.
Now, why did you have to do that?
Oh, we didn't have to. You know, it was part of, this is one of the clues to people that it was a railroad. You know, it gives you these little hints of what the, you know, what the High Line, you know, here's a girl, little girl that's come up in her bathing suit, you know, to walk in the...
It's so cute. It makes me want to put my feet in it. Describe for me sort of that final legal push, the big win that you guys got that allowed you to create this park.
You know, there wasn't one moment, but I think the biggest legal piece was when the city came on board. Giuliani really wanted to demolish the High Line. One of his last acts in office, 2 days before he left office, was signing the demolition order. So when the Bloomberg administration reversed that decision, you know, that was probably one of the biggest pieces.
And then we, when Mayor Bloomberg came into office, we did a whole economic feasibility study to show how the High Line would actually generate funds for the city through increasing property values around it. It was a very complex process.
Tell me where we are right now. What is this?
This is one of my favorite features. And it's this spot where the High Line crosses 10th Avenue. So the designers had this thought of creating this amphitheater that goes down right over 10th Avenue. So you can sit and stand and look. As you can see it right now, the taxis and cars are sort of popping out below you. It almost feels like you're in a video game.
The other thing that's amazing about this 10th Avenue Square feature, and it turns the life of the street really sort of into theater that you watch. The very mundane aspects of New York City life become theatrical. Like this whole time we've been talking, there have been those two people down there trying to get a cab. They don't know that this is the hour in New York, you can't get a cab. So I'm guessing they're from out of town because they would have given up by now if they... They just got one. Yay.
You said that you had some low moments in 2008 when the stock market crashed. Can you tell me about the party?
Yeah, it was a scary... You know, it was a scary time. We do every year a dinner called the High Line Chef's Dinner at Tom Colicchio's restaurant. And the first year we did it, it was just festive and fun. And then the second year was the night that Lehman Brothers collapsed. Half the people had to leave early and half the other people were left, you know, staring into their BlackBerries trying to figure out what was going on.
9/11, you know, was another example where, you know, I thought it was just over. I mean, not just the city, but selfishly, when I was standing on my roof watching the towers come down, one of my first thoughts was, well, you know, there goes the High Line, too. Josh's first reaction was, okay, no one, you know, we can't even talk to anyone about this. But people started calling us. What are we going to do? What are we, you know, people got more excited.
Now, if you walk the entire length of the High Line, which we did, you eventually get to a locked gate at the northern end.
So people are very envious that we're going through this fence right now.
On the other side, Section 3. This third section of the High Line has yet to be started. It stretches all the way around the West Side rail yards. CSX still owns this portion. Robert and Josh don't have the money to develop it yet. Private donors spent $150 million on the first two sections. For now, it's still what they call wild.
What we're looking at right now, this is what you first saw that day that you came up here. I mean, old rusty railroad tracks, weeds as high as your waist.
And these are going to open up
these
in blooms in about, we first came
it's
up here
so
in September, and so I that's the thing I remember.
Yeah, these are, it'll
is
all turn white. It's like snow up
you know,
to
you know, right at your waist of these sort of snowy flowers and Queen's Anne lace, sort of wading through them. I mean, to me, this was the magic that we wanted to save, and that's what I always thought. How do you capture this kind of feeling? And like right now, we're alone. It's just us up here. It's just this private garden, you know, right in the middle of New York. And it's the design influences the way people interact and changes their feeling, their perception of the city, and I think their perception of each other. I always notice that, you know, when you're up on the High Line, you see people holding hands. And I started thinking about it, and I was like, oh, you don't see that just in people walking down the street. And, you know, it's just not... New Yorkers don't do it. But, you know, on the High Line, they hold hands. And so I think that's, to me, the testimony of it really working.
Joshua David and Robert Hammond, who wrote Highline, the inside story of New York City's Park in the Sky, on top of the unfinished section of the Highline, above where? Where are we?
30th and 10th Avenue.
Above 30th and 10th Avenue. Thanks you guys so much for this wonderful tour. It's been incredible.
It's been great doing it. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for coming up.
There's so much more from our walk with Robert and Josh, like food on the High Line.
So I heard you have avocado today.
Yeah, we
do. It's my favorite.
His favorite popsicle. Robert got several.
Oh, and I get the High Line discount?
Art installations.
When you press the water fountain button, this artist piece comes. Her name's Julia Swartz.
Celebrity stories.
And I was just typing away one day, and the phone rang, and the voice on the other end said, "This is Edward Norton. I'm looking for the High Line guys."
You can hear all of that and more in a special podcast this week. If you can make it to the High Line, it makes a great walking tour. Find it at npr.org/weekendATC. Now, time for music, and a legend says farewell to his fans with one last tour and one last album. Like a ghost on a canvas, people don't see them. In the album's liner notes, Glenn Campbell writes that Ghost on the Canvas is the last studio record of new songs that I ever plan to make. That's because he's now living through the early stages of Alzheimer's. A man whose music history spans six decades is slowly losing his own history, his memories of being one of LA's top session guitarists, playing on everything from Strangers in the Night to Good Vibrations, with a combo known as the Wrecking Crew.
I got to play with the best musicians that I had ever played with. I'll just go ahead and say it. Yeah, they were the best musicians in the world.
And of course, memories of his solo career that made him a household name. And the Wichita lineman
is still on the line. Everything is fine, you know. I'm cool. It's the period I'm going through in my life, you know. I've had hurt big toes worse than that.
At 75, Glenn Campbell still retains his signature charm, his sense of humor. But more and more he relies on his wife, Kim, for the details of his life.
I'm not going to let it get me down. Or it might get me down. I don't know. I don't even know what this is. What is it, Alzheimer's? What's an Alzheimer?
It's where you start losing your memory.
I remember everything. I really do.
Well, we have good days, and then days are a little fuzzy.
Well, everybody has that, no?
That's true.
Kim and Glenn have been married for more than 25 years. She's his fourth wife, and she's the one credited with getting him off the drugs and alcohol that derailed his once stellar career. Kim says that Glenn's decision to share his diagnosis with the public didn't surprise her.
Well, Glenn's always been really open about his life and his ups and downs, his struggle with drugs and finding God. And this is just a natural thing for him to do, is to let his fans know what's going on in his life. I've tried and I have failed, Lord. I've won and I have lost. I've lived and I have loved, Lord. Sometimes that's such a cost.
It took us 2.5 years to make Ghost on the Canvas, just because we were really careful to find the songs, the right songs to say what he wanted to say, because we really wanted it to be kind of, you know, indirectly kind of like a life story.
That's Julian Raymond. He's Glenn Campbell's producer and co-writer on the album.
It's sad knowing that, you know, probably he won't be doing this anymore. He won't be able to play that amazing guitar that he does and sing with that beautiful voice. And but he's an upbeat, happy guy, and we didn't really think too much about it other than trying to make the best record that we could. Some days I'm so confused, Lord. My past gets in my way. I need the ones I love, Lord, more and more each day. Julian Raymond helped Campbell write five of the album's songs, including this one.
Now, Glenn's never considered himself a songwriter, more of a song doctor, as he puts it. He works with the writer to bring out that Glenn Campbell sound, and sometimes the lyrics just fall out of him without his even knowing it. Again, Julian Raymond.
Funny thing happened. We were standing in the kitchen of the studio one day, and we were talking about his wife, Kim, and she walked in the room, actually, when we were talking. He goes, well, you know what? He goes, there's no me without her.
There's no me without you.
So, I mean, he always comes up with these little sayings, these little things, and I wrote them down. It really turned into the lyrics of a lot of these songs.
I was wondering why he was asking me so many questions.
We shall be forever two. There's no me without you.
The album took a long time to record, but Julian Raymond says that had more to do with acquiring the right cover songs than with Glenn's condition.
We never had to stop a session because he wasn't on it. He did it. He just occasionally would get frustrated with himself. He goes, why am I doing this? Why can I not remember this? This is so easy. I can do it, you know. So he just got tough on himself sometimes.
Always working, reaching out for a hand that we can't see. Everybody's got to hold on hope. It's the last thing that's holding me.
Glenn Campbell is taking his new music on the road, on a concert tour, perhaps for the last time, in spite of his advancing memory loss.
There were people in his inner circle that were concerned that if this information came out, that maybe people wouldn't book him for fear that he would have, you know, bad shows. There were concerns that it would hurt him. And since he decided to make the diagnosis public, it's been nothing but the opposite.
Doctors have told them that playing show after show might actually help Campbell. Playing guitar, singing, constantly flexing those muscles may improve his memory retention. Another benefit to life on the road, many of Glenn Campbell's children perform in his backing band.
It's great playing with the kids because, you know, I showed them how to play. And all of them are just good players. I look forward to go out on the road with them.
I think they're really cherishing being out there with Glenn, too, because, you know, this could be his farewell tour, and they try to be strong for each other, and that's what we're trying to do, you know, with our situation.
This is not the road I wanted for us, but now that it's here, I want to make one thing perfectly clear. All I want to be for you is strong.
Glenn Campbell's farewell album is called Ghosts on the Canvas. You can hear tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Campbell's tour takes him and his family to Missouri and Arkansas next weekend.
I'm going to be the one.
And that's the podcast edition of Weekend on All Things Considered. Our program today is directed by Kenya Young and produced by Phil Harrell, with Petra Mayer, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Lauren Silverman, Megan Kane, and Arnie Spiegel. Melissa Marquis is our technical director. Rick Holter is our senior editor. And our new senior producer is Steve Lichtig. You can hear this program on your local public radio station in most places at 5 p.m. each Saturday and Sunday. Guy Raz will be back next weekend with a brand new podcast. Thanks for listening.